Dennis Lehane, author of Gone Baby Gone and Mystic River, is back in a big way. The New York Times says his new novel, Live by Night, is crime noir 101 as taught by the best of its practitioners, beginning with this first sentence. Some years later, on a tugboat in the Gulf of Mexico, Joe Coughlin's feet were placed in a tub of cement. Well, I'm going to read on. Joe Coughlin is a character carried over from Dennis's epic 2008 novel, The Given Day, which managed to include Boston's 1918 flu pandemic, anarchist bombings, molasses flood, and the bloody police strike of 1919. The Coughlins were a police family, Father Thomas, an officer, Joe's brother Danny, a cop. We wondered, whatever happened to the hard-hearted Thomas, part of Boston's Irish elite, and his boys?
Thomas and his eldest son, Aiden, hadn't spoken in years, though he did receive the occasional letter filled with bland facts, but no personal reflections. He didn't know where he lived, or even if he was alive or dead. His middle son, Connor, had been blinded during the police strike riots of 1919. Physically, he'd adapted to his infirmity with commendable speed, but mentally, it had set ablaze his inclination towards self-pity, and he'd quickly turned to alcohol. After he'd failed to drink himself to death, he found religion. And here now was Thomas's youngest son, given over to a life of crime, a life of whores and bootleggers and gun thugs, a life that always seemed to promise glamour and riches, but rarely delivered either. And now, because of his compatriots and Thomas's own men, he might not live through the night. Thomas stood in the rain and could smell nothing but the stink of his own horrid self.
Dennis Lehane reading from his new book, Live by Night, which focuses on Joe Coughlin and takes us from Prohibition-era Boston to cigar-making and rum-running in Tampa's Ybor neighborhood, as well as baseball in pre-Castro Cuba, in vibrant language that we might use a little bit of as well, just a heads up, as Dennis Lehane joins us in the studio. Dennis, good to see you.
Good to see you.
So you did it again. And as I always want to know with your books, what's true? What's true about a Joe Coughlin?
Oh, almost nothing. This book was just a sort of a pedal-to-the-metal desire to write the richest sort of gangster story I could think of. And so, no, I didn't stay true to almost anything. I mean, at this point in Tampa, in Ybor City, where I write about what was going on was the beginning of what was known as the Bolita Wars. And I don't even touch on that. I don't even go near it.
What was the Bolita Wars?
The Bolita Wars is what they call running numbers down there. Several groups, the winner being a Traficante family, who would go on to great mob success, decided that they wanted to increase their piece of the action. So a lot of bodies fell over that. But I just decided not to even go near it. I wanted to create my fictional crime kingpin.
Well, why did you need it, too? Because yours was so rich.
Right.
Your fiction. And before Joe gets to Tampa, let's back up. You know, he is in Boston where we've last seen the Coughlin family. It's Prohibition. But still, around Joe, we see the boarding houses that were operated by mobs that welcomed Irish immigrants off the docks, put them up in whorehouses, and once they rid their hair of nits and their mouths of bad teeth, these immigrants would register to vote for the mobsters' candidates. That true?
Yeah. Yeah, that detail was taken actually from T.J. English's great nonfiction account of the rise of Irish gangsters. It was called Paddywhack. And I just love that detail, so it always cataloged in my head.
Well, but let's touch on some others. Were there Irish families in which officers and cops were on different sides of the strike? To the disastrous results we see in the Coughlin family, we have, you know...
Sure. If you were of upper rank, you would have had to have been on management side. So you would have been against the rank and file. So yeah, I'm sure there were. There were fathers and sons in the Boston Police Department at that point. So that was something that happened again in The Given Day, yeah.
Yeah, and then now we have this son of privilege, Joe, who rebels and takes up a life of crime. When you're writing Joe's character, I'm reading him, and I'm thinking you. Do you do that?
My wife said that.
Do you do that? Your wife said that.
Wife said that. Yeah. I think that he's one of those characters who, for whatever reason, I got him really early. I got him when he was a little boy in The Given Day, and I understood him. I gave him certain attributes of myself, and then I could understand other aspects of him. The reasons Joe became a gangster necessarily aren't too far different from the reasons I became a writer. I mean, I think there's something in there that's sort of iconoclastic spirit and very much...
Wait a minute, because Joe ends up, you know... almost being killed, being brutally beaten, and
yeah,
killing
him. Yeah, that's where we differ.
Yeah, okay.
That's where it differs. But I think the sort of biographical, emotional terrain that you need to create a writer or a gangster isn't that far apart. And it's very specific. Joe does not come from a bad family by any means. He just comes from a family in which there was massive distance, and he doesn't fit. I didn't come from a family where there was massive distance, but as a writer, as somebody who didn't necessarily fit, I think all writers are square pegs in round holes. Yeah. The round hole being the world.
What were you, when you say you didn't fit, was there no expectation that somebody from the family would be a writer, live in their imagination?
No, I think it was more just I didn't think the way anybody else I knew thought. The whole world was thinking one way, and I was going, yeah, but, you know, and that's Joe in this book in the sense that he's seeing what his father is, and his father is a respectable member of society. He is one of the kings of Boston, or certainly one of the princes.
Police chief, yeah.
But Joe knows that he is incredibly corrupt, and then he's a brutal guy at home. And so there's this dichotomy within the, with just very basic, right in the culture. And Joe finally says, I'd rather just be an outlaw. I'd rather just be straight up.
And what's the difference, because he makes one, between being an outlaw and being a gangster?
Huge. An outlaw is somebody who just decides he's not going to follow the drumbeat of society. A gangster is somebody who says, I'm going to be part of a society. It's just going to be criminal. And that's a huge difference. And so Joe, what becomes an ever-increasing delusion as the book goes on, and I think becomes a gradually very dangerous delusion, is that he keeps thinking, I'm an outlaw. No, I'm an outlaw. I'm not really a gangster. And by the middle of the book, he's straight out gangster all the way.
Oh, yeah. It has body parts pile up around him.
Yes.
Well, let's stay in Boston, though. As my book, Joe's not only steals a mobster's girlfriend, he's part of a heist that goes terribly wrong, you know, for that mobster. And here is mobster Albert White talking to him about that. Albert's face softened. I can't let you live, Joe. If I could see any way I could, I'd try to make it work. And it's not about the girl, if that helps. I can get whores anywhere. Got a pretty new one waiting for me as soon as I'm done with you. He studies his hands. But you shot up a small town and stole $60,000 without my permission and left three cops dead. This brings a blank brown rain down on all of us. Because now every cop in New England thinks Boston gangsters are mad dogs to be put down like mad dogs. And I need to make everyone understand that's just not true. Where did you get this language? Where do you get a mobster sitting down and talking like a priest?
The hook I got into Albert was that Albert thinks in his head he'd rather just be a nice guy. He didn't really want this to be his life, but it worked out that way. He doesn't want to kill you, but he will. He doesn't want to torture you, but he will. He doesn't want to, you know, all these things. He doesn't want to extort from you, but it's his job.
Did you hang with, you know, Whitey Bulger?
Oh, God, no.
You wouldn't be here now.
No.
Is it all imagination?
It's at this point, I've studied people enough now to find ways to shade them. I don't want the bad guy who's rubbing his hands, you know, snickering with glee. That doesn't interest me at all. I want the guy who actually, in the end, the surprising thing about Albert White is that Albert White may have loved his girlfriend more than Joe loved his girlfriend. Right. I mean, that's one of the sort of tragedies of the character.
Well, Joe hooks up with another mob boss who sends him to Tampa's Ybor City. We'll pick up that thread with author Dennis Lehane's new book, Live by Night, in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with novelist Dennis Lehane. His new book, Live by Night, the main character, Joe Coughlin, carried over from Dennis's epic 2008 novel, The Given Day. Joe, the son of a high-ranking Boston police officer who rebels, becomes a gangster in Prohibition-era Boston, when, as we just heard, he runs into a lot of trouble, eventually makes his way to Tampa, Florida's Ybor City neighborhood to run mob operations there. It's fiction, of course, but as with all of Dennis's books, we wonder what's true. So, Dennis, you live part of the time in Tampa. We were there during the Republican convention. We went to Ybor City, the Cuban, Spanish, Italian section of Tampa, still preserved. It was once the center of cigar making, rum running, the Cuban Revolution, a labor movement led by women, including one we heard about, Luisa Moreno, a labor officer. You know, that was unheard of in the 1930s. There's a documentary about her in the works. But, Dennis, obviously you would be drawn to all this.
Yeah, yeah. Ybor is preserved. It is like frozen in time. You remove the cars, and the Centro Cubano, which is the Cuban social club, which is in the book, is still there, still as gorgeous as it always was. So is the Italian social club. So is the Spanish social club. The hospital where Joe ends up is now a historic inn. I mean, all of these buildings are still there. I just thought there would be a cool place to become a gangster.
And yet, let's ask you about some facts here as well. You have Cuban exiles from Ybor City blow a hole in a Navy ship with the help of Joe and gangsters just to steal weapons and ship them back to Cuba.
Yeah.
Now, we know that the Maine, you know, was blown up in Havana Harbor decades earlier. Mm-hmm. But did that really happen?
No.
Okay.
It didn't happen. But you know what's funny is the ship that I had them blow up was a real ship. And what it was doing was it was spending a lot of time around Central and South America, right at the point when the U.S. government was building the School of the Americas, which is the training camp for dictators and death squads. So there's a lot of unaccounted activity for that ship. So I just thought, well, why not blow a hole in it, see what happens.
See what comes out. How about the Ku Klux Klan, which suddenly surfaces in Tampa? The ugly strain.
And they surfaced. One of the big flowerings of the Ku Klux Klan was in the Depression, because what they did is they tapped into the sort of populist rage, and they tapped into this idea that people weren't losing their jobs because the economy went in the tank, because that was too difficult to explain. People were losing their jobs because they were getting stolen by immigrants. So the Ku Klux Klan began to flourish again, and that's something that I thought would be interesting when you have this mobster who by no means am I saying is a hero by any means, but at least the very thing that Joe is he is authentic. He is not pretending to be anything else. He is not wrapping himself in any sort of flag. He is not wrapping himself in any sort of cloth. He is not pretending that he is anything but what he is. And I found that interesting to pit that against a sort of evangelical fervor and then definitely sort of the KKK.
Yeah.
Not sort of, definitely the KKK.
What about the woman Joe meets in Ybor City, Graciela? Graciela?
Graciela, yeah.
Who is a cigar roller,
yeah,
by day, revolutionary by night.
Yep.
When we were in Ybor City, we heard of some documentaries that are now being planned telling the story of women from Ybor City who were leaders in the labor. There was a march in, I guess, 1937. Women led the march.
Yeah.
Was she part of that history again, or were you?
I was building her toward that, but then the book takes a
yeah,
move away.
Which we won't tell.
Which we won't tell. But the single most important position in a cigar factory was the reader, basically the person who stood on the floor, and they read all day to keep the cigar rollers entertained.
Right.
And what they tended to do was they tended to read far more radical or left-wing tracts. They were basically reading workers' rights manifestos. So the cigar workers formed unions very fast, and there were a lot of strikes. And some of them turned very violent, and the Ku Klux Klan were brought in to break up the strikes.
Which they were happy to do because the cigar workers were people of color.
People of color, exactly. Yeah. So what happened was there was a massive, massive strike in the end of the late 1930s, and it ground to a halt, and the owners said, this time we're digging in. And they dug in, and they won. One of their big demands that changed everything was they said, you can all go back to work, you can keep your jobs, we'll give you an extra 50 cents a day, whatever it was, but no more readers. It was the height of the Great Depression, and they leveraged their power, and they wiped out the single most powerful position. And I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah, and me too, and the fact that it was a woman.
Some of the strikebreakers were women. Some of the most powerful voices in Ybor City at that time were women.
What are we to make of, and I can't wait to see what's next, because here you have sort of the history of alcohol during the Prohibition, and mm-hmm, Joe becomes very successful. We're not going to, look, the first sentence is he's on a tug with his feet being put in cement. But I couldn't see the ending coming at all. What are you saying, if anything, about, this idea of these people who were involved in alcohol? We know that when it became legal, some of them became very respectable.
Very respectable.
Yeah.
Very respectable. In the follow-up to this, Joe actually buys, Joe Coughlin buys Joe Kennedy's plane.
Wait, you just gave away the ending.
Well.
Okay.
Maybe he lives, maybe he doesn't. Maybe it's another Joe Coughlin. Maybe there's twins.
Maybe he has children. I'm just saying.
But anyway, yes. So somebody buys Joe Kennedy's plane because he's not using it anymore, because
wow,
he's bought his respectability. It's the Balzac line, behind every great fortune is a crime. I think that's true. You buy your way into respectability, which becomes one of the questions of this book. In the end, can you follow bad deeds with good money? And that's not just a question about the characters in this book. Can you do a bunch of bad deeds that get you profit and then turn around and take that profit and try to help people?
And do good.
And is there any sort of karmic justice?
Yeah.
And I think that's also a question that revolves around gunboat diplomacy. I mean, that's something that, can we go in and bomb the hell out of countries for their own good and then rebuild them? I mean, we did it in Germany once, seemed to work out okay. But we've done it in Iraq for a while, and it doesn't seem to work out okay. So that becomes and Cuba is a great symbol certainly in the Caribbean of gunboat diplomacy, because we took them over in 1900 and held on until 1959. Mm-hmm. And there was a question as to whether we were good for them or bad for them.
Well, and the answer is different depending on which Cuban you ask.
Sure.
Yeah.
And which American you ask, and
right,
which,
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so has the follow-up been completely written?
No, it's close. I'm fascinated by certain moments in history that are small but seismic. And one is that in 1943, the United States government could not stop German saboteurs. They were blowing up boats at a really scary rate. I think it was at one point it was 12 a month. And they finally went to the American mafia and they said, we're not even going to play anymore. You control the waterfront. We can't pretend we don't. Every time we send an agent in, you beat his head in and send him back to us. Would you take care of German saboteurs for us? And the mob said, sure, if you give us what we want. And what they got was Bugsy Siegel. They got Bugsy Siegel sprung from prison at the end of World War II. And that was the deal. And that was the first time. It was called Operation Underworld. And it was the very first time there was clear collusion between the United States government and the American mafia. And some say that collusion led to a lot of terrible events in the 1960s.
Well, Dennis Lehane, this is your turf, noir. There's a lot of brains that get blown out, you know?
Yeah, yeah. This is a high body count book.
Did you ever see yourself leaving that?
I don't see myself doing Downton Abbey. I mean, certainly The Given Day is not a book in which too many brains get blown out.
No.
It's not a book.
People get killed by molasses floods.
Floods, exactly. So these books interest me because they're a way to look at sort of the underworld history of the United States, which has been done. It's been done by James Ellroy. It's been done by Don DeLillo. And now it's something that I'm interested in and just sort of seeing the way the cross currents worked. But am I ever going to write a book in which people sit around in very genteel surroundings and talk about tea and croquet? I'd say it's highly unlikely.
Dennis Lehane, his new book is Live by Night. And by the way, the title comes from the concept that Joe has that there are people who live by day, they have respectable jobs, and there are people who live by night.
Yes.
Terrific read, Live by Night. Dennis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from Live by Night at hereandnow.org and know you will still be surprised by the ending. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.